Listen to it, Paul. Listen to the voice.
Hello and welcome to Media Geek. This is your weekly look at the world of grassroots and independent media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. My name is Paul Rees-Manel and I'm your host. On today's program, a mega merger on the horizon that might create old Ma Bell. And also, a dig back into the Media Geek archives to hear from Russ Forster, who has an 8-track mind. All that on today's Media Geek. Do stay tuned. It's been another big week in our telecommunications environment. The biggest news is the surprise announcement by AT&T on March 5th that the company intends to buy fellow Baby Bell company Bell South in a deal worth $67 billion in stock trades. Now that SBC has taken on the name of the former telephone monopoly, the intention to buy up Bell South looks a lot like the reformation of Ma Bell some 20 years after it was broken up. If the AT&T Bell South deal is approved by regulators, the company would end up controlling four of the original seven regional Bell operating companies that were created by the original breakup of AT&T in 1984. Public interest and consumers groups are obviously concerned about what the merger's effect on consumers would be. Consumers Union and the Consumer Federation of America joined together to announce that the groups would be asking the Justice Department to reject the deal. In a press release, Gene Kimmelman, Vice President for Federal and International Affairs for Consumers Union, said, quote, "If approved, this merger will lead to higher local, long-distance, and cell phone prices for consumers across the country," end quote. In many places across the Southeast, including the Carolinas and Florida, AT&T is the only competitor to Bell South. Kimmelman points out that in those regions, AT&T would become a near monopoly for telephone and DSL services if its acquisition of Bell South were to go through. Mark Cooper, director of research for the Consumer Federation of America, characterized the merger this way, quote, "Telecommunications has now gone from a regulated monopoly to an unregulated duopoly with just two major players," end quote. Of course, the proposed merger has its fans too, especially from corners like the Brookings Institute. In a Wall Street Journal op-ed, Brookings' Robert Crandall and Clifford Winston argued, quote, "As long as international borders are open, competition flourishes even without an antitrust authority. It will be extremely difficult for anyone to argue with much credibility before a federal judge how the AT&T Bell South merger will affect the prices and output of telecom or video services for the foreseeable future," end quote. And yet, the AT&T that is now again big enough to gobble up one more Baby Bell has had a pretty rocky time with consumers and regulators in its previous incarnation as SBC. Before it bought AT&T, SBC grew through the acquisition of other regional Bell companies. Beginning life as Southwestern Bell, the company became SBC when it purchased Pacific Bell just a year after the Telecommunications Act of 1996 was passed. SBC actually tried to buy AT&T back in 1997, but that deal was killed by the Federal Communications Commission. Reed Hunt, then the FCC's chair, called the idea, quote, "unthinkable," end quote. 2 years later, in 1999, SBC completed the acquisition of the large Baby Bell Ameritech, which served Midwest states like Illinois and Ohio. However, that transition did not go smoothly for many Ameritech customers. The chief information officer of a large IT company in Chicago recently told Computer World magazine that his company saw many service disruptions as a result of the Ameritech takeover. Residential customers in states like Illinois and Michigan saw their telephone rates rise almost immediately, despite promises to the contrary made by SBC before the deal went through. In December 1999, the Illinois Citizens Utility Board filed an appeal of the SBC-Ameritech merger with the State Commerce Commission, noting that SBC customers in Illinois were paying more to call 15 miles away than to call long distance to New York or California. A year into the merger, Newspapers in states served by Ameritech, as well as the telecommunications press, were filled with stories of a severe drop in customer service. On October 6, 2000, the FCC's Common Carrier Bureau sent a letter to SBC admonishing it for deteriorating service, saying that Ameritech customers were, quote, experiencing increasing installation delays, longer repair times, and greater difficulties contacting the company, end quote. In 2001, Ameritech halted its promised rollout of broadband DSL internet service across Illinois as the result of a dispute with the state's Commerce Commission, leaving thousands of customers in the lurch and without any broadband options whatsoever. In 2002, the Michigan Alliance for Competitive Telecommunications released a report that tabulated a total of $1 billion in fines that had been issued to SBC by local, state, and federal officials starting in 1996. $25 million of those fines had been issued for SBC's conduct in Michigan beginning in 1999. And last year, the Center for Public Integrity reported that two-thirds of all fines issued by the FCC between 2000 and 2005 went to the Baby Bells, mostly for violations of the 1996 Telecom Act. SBC ranked third in FCC fines at $11.5 million. In much of the analysis that has come out in the industry press since the March 5th announcement of the AT&T Bell South deal, there's been an air of inevitability about it, given SBC's clear record of rapid expansion. And yet back in 1998, SBC CEO Edward Whitaker Jr. appeared before the Senate Commerce Committee to discuss the company's intention to acquire Ameritech. Whitaker told senators the following, quote, "I'd also like to address a concern raised by some who have suggested that SBC and Ameritech have set out to turn back the clock and recreate the old AT&T Bell system," end quote. He went on to say, quote, "Nothing could be further from the truth. The competition genie is out of the bottle," end quote. What a difference 8 years makes. Beyond expanding its reach into more states, the big prize to be won through acquiring Bell South is singular: the nation's largest wireless phone provider. AT&T currently co-owns Singular with Bell South, and a merger would make AT&T the nation's largest provider of both conventional wired telephone and wireless services. And you're listening to Media Geek. I'm your host, Paul Riesmandel, and today I'm taking a broad look at the proposed merger between AT&T and Bell South, set to create the largest telephone and wireless company in the country, and trying to figure out what might the effects be on consumers and our internet. You can check out Media Geek online at www.mediageek.net, where I have been trying to cover this deal and look at different aspects of it. You can get it up to the minute, up to date at mediageek.net. You can also get this radio program online at radio.mediageek.net. You can download it or subscribe to the podcast to get it automatically downloaded to your computer or MP3 player. That's radio.mediageek.net. The announcement of the proposed merger is causing reverberations throughout Washington as congresspeople and the FCC try to figure out what it means and what to do. One person sure to be affected is Robert McDowell, President Bush's nominee to fill the last open seat at the FCC. That's because McDowell is the Assistant General Counsel for CompTel, the industry group representing the small telecommunications companies that compete against the likes of AT&T and Verizon. Last year, CompTel opposed the SBC-AT&T merger. Earl Comstock, CEO of CompTel, gave testimony highly critical of AT&T and Verizon during last month's Senate Commerce Committee hearing on network neutrality, accusing the nation's largest telcos of reneging on promises like bringing very high-speed internet access to consumers around the country. If CompTel formally opposes the AT&T Bell South merger, the FCC and McDowell may have to consider that he recuse himself. A McDowell recusal would give more leverage to the FCC's Democrats by eliminating the Republicans' one-seat majority at the commission. Democratic Commissioners Michael Copps and Jonathan Adelstein are considered to be much more critical of such large mergers and stronger defenders of the public interest than the commission's Republicans. Because a majority yes vote is necessary for the FCC to approve the deal, the commission's Democrats could have an easier time forcing concessions or blocking the merger outright. Yet, even if McDowell doesn't recuse himself, it's still a tough call on which way he would lean with regard to the AT&T-Bell South merger. It's unclear how consistent with Comptel's positions his own views are. McDowell had his confirmation hearing in front of the Senate Commerce Committee on March 9th, where he told senators that his experience at Comptel wouldn't affect his ability to be fair and neutral at the FCC. He said, quote, "It would be my duty as a commissioner to wipe the slate clean, to start from scratch, and to examine each issue de novo," end quote. All three senators present at the sparsely attended meeting questioned McDowell on the conflict of interest issue, and they all also expressed support for his confirmation. Senate Commerce Committee Chair Ted Stevens said the committee may vote on McDowell's nomination as soon as March 16th. That committee is also likely to make a review of the AT&T-Bell South merger itself, according to committee staffers. The committee's top Democrat, Daniel Inouye of Hawaii, made critical statements about the deal, saying it, quote, "calls into question whether the future of communications policy will be marked by strategies to promote vigorous competition or by further efforts to facilitate new mergers," end quote. Both the top Republican and Democrat on the Senate Judiciary Antitrust Subcommittee said they will hold hearings on the proposed AT&T-Bell South merger, too. Over in the House, Judiciary Chairman James Sensenbrenner, a Republican from Wisconsin, said his panel, quote, "plans to aggressively scrutinize the proposed transaction and the state of competition in the broader telecommunications marketplace to reduce the risk of consumer harm from any proposed mergers," end quote. With the specter of an even larger AT&T looming, the issue of network neutrality is staying in the spotlight and becoming an even hotter potato in House and Senate committees. This past week, the House Energy and Commerce Committee was hashing out the details of its telecommunications overhaul legislation, and network neutrality is reportedly one item on which agreement has not been reached. The House panel's key Democrats and Republicans are reported to have reached an agreement in principle on the terms of allowing the big telephone companies to begin offering cable TV services over broadband lines. The terms would give the telcos a nationwide franchise they've been lobbying for, relieving them of the burden of having to negotiate individual contracts with local municipalities as currently required under law. And yet, according to critics, it's the ability to offer video services over telephone companies' broadband lines that makes network neutrality all the more important. It seems logical that AT&T or Verizon wouldn't want video content available on the public internet to compete with the video channels offered by their broadband cable services. Providing for network neutrality in law could ensure that internet providers would not be able to charge prejudicial rates to content creators for reaching subscriber homes. Network neutrality provisions might also limit the ability of internet service providers to create tiers of service that at lower levels would limit or block the flow of data from content creators who don't have contracts with the ISP. Although the companies say they support network neutrality in principle, executives from both AT&T and Bell South have made public comments in the last 6 months saying they would like to charge content providers like Google and Yahoo, complaining that companies that provide high-bandwidth multimedia to consumers are getting a free ride on the telco's broadband lines that consumers are already paying for. On March 7th, Senate Commerce Committee Chair Ted Stevens told reporters that he won't let the proposed merger slow down his committee's consideration of telecom legislation that he would like to see pass before the Easter recess. Stevens said he does not share the critical take on the merger of his fellow committee member Daniel Inouye, saying that what's developing now is, quote, "an entirely different communications picture for the entire country," end quote. It is yet unclear whether any network neutrality provisions will make it into the Senate's version of telecom legislation either, but it may be that network neutrality could make it into the approval process for the AT&T-Bell South merger. Largely due to pressure from Commission Democrats, last year the FCC placed temporary network neutrality terms on its approval of SBC's acquisition of AT&T and Verizon's purchase of MCI. A bigger push to make these provisions stronger and possibly permanent may come up at the FCC and from Congress. Representative Ed Markey, the ranking Democrat on the House Internet Subcommittee, said that he believes network neutrality will be a key issue in reviewing the impact of the merger. Regardless of how this merger and other telecom issues work out this year, one thing that seems relatively certain is that the big telephone companies will probably be making a big entry into cable TV. And if the compromise worked out between Democrats and Republicans on the House Energy and Commerce Committee are any indication, it looks like the telcos are going to get the field plowed for them with a national franchise of some sort, although the specifics are still up in the air. The most significant aspect of such a change is that it almost instantaneously turns the likes of AT&T and Verizon into media companies, with both enormous resources and enormous power in Congress. While some might argue that the telco's entry into cable TV adds up to more competition, it also means the addition of big players who have the resources to expand their holdings into the entertainment and media sectors. Given the proclivities of merger-happy CEO Edward Whittaker, why wouldn't AT&T want to vertically integrate its video business with the purchase of entertainment content producers and cable channels? This rapidly changing landscape should remind us that the issue of media ownership is still waiting on the horizon, nearly 2 years after the Third Circuit Court of Appeals tossed out the FCC's last attempt at revising and loosening ownership rules. FCC Chairman Kevin Martin has pledged to take up media ownership once the empty Republican seat on the commission is filled. Right now, it looks like that's no more than a month away, as there is little to no Senate opposition to nominee Robert McDowell. As I reported on Media Geek last week, key congresspeople addressed a gathering of the National Association of Broadcasters during the week of February 27th. Many of them advocated for lifting the cross-ownership ban that prevents co-ownership of newspapers and television stations in a local market. An aide to New Hampshire Senator John Sununu told broadcasters that it is likely that Congress will step in to help the FCC in relaxing rules like the cross-ownership ban. Yet, Representative Joe Barton, chair of the House Energy and Commerce Committee, and like Sununu, also a Republican, was more cautious in his remarks on the issue, saying that he didn't plan to move any legislation to address it. Nevertheless, it is certain that public interest and consumers groups will have their plates full this year as they attempt to hold the line against mega mergers and efforts to pave the way for even greater consolidation in both the telecommunications and media industries, even as the two very quickly turn into one enormous industry. And that is some of the really important stuff going on in our media environment. You're listening to Media Geek. I'm Paul Riesmandel. If you have any comments about the program, I'd love to hear them. Send them on to me, paul@mediageek.net. Check out the program online at radio.mediageek.net. And of course, check out the Media Geek blog at mediageek.net. In just a moment, we're going to lighten things up a little bit and hear from a man with an 8-track mind, Russ Forster. Do stay tuned. And you are listening to Media Geek. I'm your host, Paul Riesmandel. This is your weekly look at the world of grassroots and independent media. And I've been doing it since 2002. And this month, the month of March 2006, I'm celebrating the fourth anniversary of Media Geek. Because I wasn't sure it would last this long. And I certainly didn't think I'd get the opportunity to communicate to people via the internet and via many more community radio stations who've joined on to air Media Geek. And I do want to say thank you. And also take a look back at some of the interviews I've done and things I've covered that were fun and interesting. So one of my first very favorite interviews is with Russ Forster. He's an independent media maker who started a zine called 8-Track Mind back in the 1990s. It was very successful, and it looked at the phenomena of people who collect and like 8-track tapes, a medium largely forgotten with the advent of cassettes and CDs, and yet with still a passionate underground following because of the fact that it is maligned, but also because of the fact that it's absurdly cheap. You could get new music for pennies, for quarters, and you get players very cheap, and just is a way of saying no to the corporate media monolith that says you need to upgrade to the newest, greatest format. But Russ isn't just an 8-track guy. He's also a filmmaker. He made a documentary film about 8-track collectors. It's a great, great film called So Wrong, They're Right. He also made a documentary about tribute bands called Tributary. And I got a chance to meet Russ sort of by the way, or really didn't expect to, at the 2002 Underground Publishing Conference, which is now called the Allied Media Conference. And I really had a great time hanging out and talking with Russ. I find him to be a real inspiration still in terms of his attitude about independent media making for the sheer passion of it. And so here's some excerpts of that interview, which first aired on July 19th, 2002. Russ Forster.
I have this burning passion for saying certain things, presenting my view of the world to other people, and kind of my skewed vision of, I don't know, of Americana, perhaps. And maybe I see the 8-track documentary and the tribute band documentary as sort of historical documentation of this weird pop culture American, purely American kind of stuff. And it's weird. I think that people don't really appreciate it now, but in 50 years, they're going to be looking at it like, wow, that's what the 90s were about.
Well, let's look at this, because you became well-known for your 8-track mind scene, which is what allowed you to do, or why you got the sort of impetus to do the documentary.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, why that? I mean, to a lot of people, that's a bunch of garbage in a box at a garage sale, you know, that no one cares about. We've got CDs, you know. Well, why waste your time on that?
Just actually, the zine started my part in the zine started just kind of by accident, or almost as sort of a dare. I just ran into people around the country in the late 80s when I was touring with bands who were into 8-tracks the same way I was into 8-tracks in Chicago, where I was living at the time. And I just thought, wow, there's a community here but that hasn't really been realized as a community. There are pockets of people doing the same thing around the country, and they don't know that there are these other pockets. So I just sort of wanted to do an experiment, try to bring these different people together, and I thought maybe there'd be 100 people, and it would last about 5 issues, and I was completely blown away with the response. At the highest print run, I was doing 2,000 issues and had over 200 subscribers, and it was really out of control compared to what I originally thought it would be.
And so I mean, why? I mean, why did that touch you? Why were you in 8-tracks?
That was another accident. So a person who lived next door to me, where I was living in Chicago, was left for Los Angeles, and she had a bunch of 8-tracks and a player and just didn't want to take them with her. So she asked me if I wanted them. So for free, I had this whole collection of music and a player. And then I realized, hey, the thrift stores are overflowing with great 8-tracks, and it's only 40 cents.
And people throw them away, even though the music on them is still probably, you know, it's still good.
Sure, I learned quickly how to fix the tape. Yeah. So the main complaint that people have about 8-tracks, the tape splice breaking and it screwing up in the player, I had mastered within a few months. So I felt like I can really make these things fly. And it's a cheap way to get to experiment with music that I may not have ever had a chance to experiment with. I bought a lot of soul tapes, and I never really bought soul records just because I didn't grow up with them, and it was a lot to at $3 a pop, I didn't want to take a lot of chances, but at 25 cents a pop, I'll buy it all.
It sort of represented a way for you to sort of engage in culture, really, without all the same, you know, overhead, kind of.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. It all of a sudden became a fun way to turn garbage into gold. And then I had friends who were doing much the same thing, and we would have parties where we'd just play 8-tracks, and we'd bring out all our disco stuff. We'd bring 8-tracks to this bowling alley. We'd bowl once a week and bring our 8-track, our own music, so that we could have our own disco music and do our own disco bowling thing. It was just this explosion of weird expression out of this trash.
And was it really rewarding? I mean, to to see this happen from just, you know, finding this and then making a zine and then all of a sudden finding out there's a whole bunch of other people like me out there.
Absolutely, absolutely. And it's still to this day when I get an email, which doesn't happen as often as it used to, but every month or so I get an email from someone who's just like, I saw your magazine or I saw the 8-Track Heaven website and it changed my life. I didn't think anybody else was into 8-Tracks in the same way, and it's so great to know that there are other people out there who are having fun with it and it's not all just collectors on eBay. And
so, you know, you've done two documentary films, and you've done zining, and it seems like, is there sort of a trajectory when you found yourself doing more and more of this kind of stuff and less of something else in your life where, you know, doing sort of mediating was more your occupation of your time?
I think I have this underground bent. I'm just stuck in the underground, and I'm not going to come out, and I love it here, and I feel comfortable here. I feel comfortable in a room full of geeky people who read a lot and listen to weird music and put out weird records of their own and of their friends. And I love the personal touch that the underground offers, and I don't really find it in other places. I go to, you know, if I went to Sundance, if my film or video got into Sundance and I hung out with those people, I'm sure I would feel like a total fish out of water. I wouldn't know. These are industry people. They're talking money. They're talking all this other stuff. And that I guess I should like money more than I do, but it's not the be-all and end-all.
And that is the man who has an 8-track mind. Russ Forrester, the man behind the zine of the same name, as well as the films So Wrong, They're Right About 8-Tracks and Tributary. In an interview that originally aired on Media Geek June 19th, 2002. That brings to a close another edition of Media Geek. I'm your host and producer, Paul Riesmandel, and I'll be back in 1 week with more news about grassroots and independent media, as well as our media environment. In the meantime, check out Media Geek online at MediaGeek.net, where you'll find the Media Geek blog with frequently updated news and views about our media. You can also download the program at Radio.MediaGeek.net or subscribe to the podcast to have it automatically downloaded to your computer or MP3 player. That's all at MediaGeek.net. The closing music is Fire in the Sky by Adam Lowe. Media Geek is produced live at Community Radio WEFT in Champaign, Illinois. Some segments are pre-recorded at Media Geek Studios. And Media Geek is heard on 9 other community stations around North America, including KRFP in Moscow, Idaho, KQRP in Salida, California, KRBS in Oroville, California, WSLR in Sarasota, Florida, WTND in Macomb, Illinois, WRFA in Jamestown, New York, CKDU in Halifax, Nova Scotia, and Free Radio Olympia in Olympia, Washington. Media Geek is free to air on your local community radio station, too. Just drop me a line at paul@mediageek.org. That email address is also good for any comments you want to send in about the program. Once again, that's paul@mediageek.org. Thanks for tuning in.